We're going to begin with enchantment and Christian worship. And for that, I first want to talk briefly about theology. Because theology, for most of the Christian tradition, was regarded as, well, a rather important discipline. It was often considered the queen of the sciences. And it's difficult for you and me to imagine such a time that theology was queen of the sciences. The modern period, I think, has taught us to look to other sources other than theology, for guides on how to establish our life together. The argument that theology would be the most important guide for our common life and also for our public life together seems profoundly presumptuous to many who've grown up in modern liberal democracies. In fact, many would regard the claim of theology being the queen of the sciences as striking at the root of our cultural arrangement. And don't tell anyone, but well, perhaps it does. Perhaps it does. I won't dispute that claim. Certainly, it seems unsurprising and logical considering that modernity takes its cue from earthly rather than heavenly realities. And so, the basic dissident choice that I think our liberal democratic cultural arrangement has taken, the dissident choice has been to take temporal goods for ultimate ends. Worship, as every one of you knows, I'm sure, worship has to do with ultimate ends. In fact, worship is the one and only thing that truly is, as St. Augustine would have it, the one and only thing that really is about ultimate ends. There's a great book, by the way, that recently came out and that I do have to put a plug in for, and that is Jamie Smith's book, James K.A. Smith's book, Awaiting the King. It talks about, well, worship being the ultimate end and awaiting the King. And it places everything in terms of our cultural, economic, and especially also political arrangements in light of that ultimate telos of Christ's return, the ultimate end of Christ's return. I'm in agreement with Jamie Smith's main thesis in that book, Awaiting the King. And I also agree with John Milbank's oft-quoted statement, namely, the pathos of modern theology is its false humility. Its false humility. For theology, this must be a fatal disease, he writes. This is at the beginning of his book, Theology and Social Theory. Must be a fatal disease. If theology no longer seeks to position, to qualify, to criticize other discourses, then it's inevitable those discourses will position theology. That's a rather bold claim, and John Milbank is known for his bold claims. But I think he's fundamentally right. Theology, it's inherent to theology to position other discourses and not to be afraid to engage with them, and also, if necessary, where necessary, to criticize them. And so if political, economic arrangements feel threatened by the view that theology ought to be our primary discipline, then perhaps that's an indication that in some sense, those two really are incompatible. That there's at least a tension between modernity and the theological convictions of the great tradition. So I'm going to be rather unapologetic about that throughout these sessions over the next couple of days. None of that is to suggest that I'm going to be doing battle throughout these sessions with the outside economic and political forces that we may be facing. I won't. But I will be taking some aim at developments within our own Christian tradition, within theology itself, which I think have influenced those cultural presuppositions that you and I typically work with. And all of that with the aim of a re-enchantment of worship. The aim of a re-enchantment of worship, which is grounded in reality, actually. Because I think that while we may talk a lot about re-enchanting the universe and so on, the universe is, whether we recognize it or not, the universe is an enchanted place. And it's a matter of getting our epistemic arrangements and our understanding of it in line with the universe that always already is enchanted. Those of you who may perhaps be familiar with heavenly participation, I don't use the language of enchantment there. I talk about sacramental ontology. Really, I mean one and the same thing. So if you're wondering about translation issues here, I talk about re-enchantment or so, or enchantment. If the universe is enchanted, that is, in terms of my book, Heavenly Participation, a universe that is sacramental in character. So sticking for a moment with that term ontology, ontos, being, that term ontology may put some people slightly on edge, particularly for those of us within evangelical tradition. It may seem to place us in an area of abstract metaphysical thought, and the question may come up, should Christians be at all engaged in metaphysics? Should they be concerned in any way with ontology? Aren't we in danger, if we do that, of losing the particulars of the Christian faith, and especially the particulars of the biblical narrative? Aren't we running the danger of losing sight of the primary character also of Christian worship? Those are not objections to simply shove aside, I think. They are serious objections, and they're important objections. I do think we must take Christian worship as foundational. Whenever we do want to talk about a metaphysic or an ontology, that must be something that is, at the very least, in line with or compatible with the scriptures. And it also seems to me that we dare not lose sight of the centrality of the church, of the ecclesia, as a community within which all our discourse, also our metaphysical discourse, must take place. All the same, having made those important caveats, the Christian tradition, throughout the centuries, at least until the late Middle Ages, did work consciously, and after that, I think, subconsciously, did work with a certain ontology, with a certain metaphysic. We all work with that, whether we're aware of it or not. And unfortunately, it seems to me, the ontology of those of us who say, well, we really don't need an ontology, in fact, we should not have one, typically that tends to result in the adoption of a metaphysic, or a metaphysic version of it, of modernity. But I do agree, again, with a cautionary comment that a Christian metaphysic, Christian ontology, must be centered on Jesus Christ. That it must take seriously the worshiping visible church. And that it needs to take very seriously the church's engagement with the divine scriptures. And I think those concerns were safeguarded, for the most part at least, within Christian Platonism of the Christian tradition. Those concerns were safeguarded, I think, within the Christian Platonic tradition of the faith. So let's unpack in a little bit more detail what I understand with a sacramental ontology and by the Christian Platonism on which it relies. The basic premise of that is that people throughout the Middle Ages tended to look at the world as mystery. Now that word mystery did not always have the same connotation that it typically does for us when we say something is a mystery to us, and by that we mean we need to solve this little puzzle, right? Or like a mystery novel that we're curious about. Mystery, the Christian tradition, means something else. It refers to realities behind the sensible, observable appearances. The realities behind them, which imply that whatever we may access by means of our hands, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, we don't fully access reality. We don't fully comprehend reality once we've taken the DNA of something. It's simply an acknowledgement of, say, Gerard Manley Hopkins' famous line that the world is charged with the grandeur of God. That the being that we have is a shared being, is a being that we borrow from the Creator Himself. The created world cannot be reduced, in other words, to measurable, manageable dimensions. Those are part of the world, nothing wrong with them. You won't hear anything anti-scientific from me. But the world, we dare not reduce the world to those dimensions. And in some ways, I suspect that's uncontroversial. Many of us, when we think about it, will agree. When we try to comprehend, quote unquote, reality, there's a sense in which we find that at least difficult and perhaps impossible to do. The reason isn't because our senses don't function properly. It is because, in some sense, most of us encounter the world as a mysterious reality. And throughout the great tradition, when people had that sense of recognition that there is more to the world than just what we access with the senses, that it's not just sensible realities. People throughout the Christian tradition use sacramental language for it. And they would talk about the world, therefore, created order, therefore, as sacramentum in Latin. Sacramentum. So I'm not talking here about ecclesial sacraments. It's a related issue, actually. We'll get to that at some point. It's a related issue. I'm simply talking about the realities that we encounter in our everyday world. Sacramenta, plural, sacraments. And these sacraments were regarded as signs of a mysterium, a mystery, which was present somehow within these realities, and sustained them in being. The reality of observable objects, therefore, the realities of those objects transcend our observation, first of all, but transcend, secondly, also, and more importantly, perhaps, our comprehension. Whenever I talk about these things, I have to think of St. Gregory of Nyssa. He's one of my favorite theologians, 4th century mystic, and also a deep doctrinal thinker. Those things all should go together, right? Gregory of Nyssa, 4th century theologian, he had this big argument with Eunomius, Neo-Arian theologian. And Eunomius said, because God is, to be God means to be unbegotten, well, therefore, only the Father truly is God, because only the Father is unbegotten. Gregory of Nyssa got all worked up. You think you can define God, right? God equals unbegotten. To be God is to be unbegotten. That's how you've put God in your little box. You cannot comprehend God. And Gregory then would go on to say, neither can you even comprehend yourself. Right? And that's the point here. You can't even comprehend yourself, nor can you comprehend anything that you encounter in the world around you. It's all, in that sense, incomprehensible. Now, don't get me wrong, he wasn't saying that every created object is God, is God, is God, right? But there is an incomprehensible essence, if you want to use that language. There is an incomprehensible depth to the created world, a mysterious depth that makes the world an enchanted place, that makes the entire universe, the entire created order, enchanted. It's enchanted because it's carried by depth, by depths, by dimensions, or your sacramental language, mystery, that we cannot access either by the senses or by the human intellect. Let me take the next step. There's a distinction I make in my book, Heavenly Participation, between signs and sacraments. It's an important distinction for us moderns to wrap our minds around. What a sign does is it points away from itself to something else. Right? So when I'm driving along the road, it's an example I use in the book, or when you drive along the road and you see a sign that has a deer on it, it's a sign. And it points away from itself to something else. Right? The deer out in the forest. Those two are separate realities. Symbol X to symbol, only a symbol. Symbol X and reality Y are unconnected. Right? They point to each other, or the one points to the other. Things are different with sacramental language. And again, I'm not talking here, although it has implications for the Eucharist when we get to that. I'm not talking here about ecclesial sacrament. But sacrament, including the created order, therefore, including you and me as human beings. Sacraments. With sacraments, the sacrament, the sign, yes, points to the reality, but makes the reality present. It makes the reality present. Why? Because the sacrament participates in the reality. Because it's a depth dimension, the reality is a depth dimension, it is present in. It enchants the object. It renders the object into something sacred. It renders the object into something, in some sense, sacred. C.S. Lewis, who I love for this stuff, C.S. Lewis has an essay titled Transposition, and he there too makes this distinction between symbolism and sacramentalism. And he talks there, first of all, about the relationship between speech and writing. He says the relationship between speech and writing is simply one of symbolism. The written characters, he says, exist only for the eye. Spoken words only for the ear. There's complete discontinuity between them. They're not like each other. The one doesn't cause the other to be. But, and then he uses an example of how sacraments work. Pictures, he says. Pictures and the visible world are related in a different manner to each other. Pictures, he writes, are part of the visible word themselves. This is participation language, right? Sacramental language. Pictures are part of the visible world themselves and represented only by being part of it, participating in it, by being part of it. Their visibility has the same source. The suns and the lamps in pictures, they seem to shine. Why? Well, only because real suns or lamps, whatever it is, shine on them. That is, they seem to shine a great deal because they really do shine a little in reflecting their archetypes, the originals. Sunlight in a picture is therefore not related to real sunlight simply as written words are spoken in the earlier example that we used. No, it's a sign, but also more than a sign, he says. More than a sign, right? Because in the thing signified, in it, the thing signified is really in a certain mode present. Note the sacramental language that he is using, right? He's saying there's real presence here. And again, he's not talking about the Eucharist, right? He's not talking about the Eucharist. But there is real presence here. Because, again, the thing signified, the light, is in some mode present here. If I had to name the relation, it sounds rather reluctant. If I had to name the relation, I should call it not symbolical, but sacramental. Oh yes, that's what he's been thinking about all of them, of course. A sacramental relationship implies, for Lewis, real presence. You could summarize the difference like this. With a symbol, there is strictly external or nominal relationship. Now that term nominal, we want to remember because we're going to come back to that when I discuss nominalism. Don't have to worry about nominalism for now, but I'll get back to that later. So there is a strictly external or nominal relationship. However, when we recognize the mysterious character of the world, there is not just an external or nominal, but there is a participatory or real, a participatory or real connection. It's the kind of thinking that grounds itself in biblical texts such as Acts 17, St. Paul's sermon on the Areopagus. For in him we live and move and have our being. So the way we exist is by way of participation in God. The way in which other created objects exist is by way of participating in the life of God. Similarly, Colossians 1:17, He, Christ that is, He is before all things, and in him, all things hold together. In him, all things hold together. Again, to quote Lewis here, we do not want to merely see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else, which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see. And I use a small b here. But I think he means capital B, right? To be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe into it, to become part of it. In other words, the beautiful objects that we may see, they remind us, they quote unquote tempt us, they work on our desire. Again, another plug for James Smith's work. His first book, the title of Desiring the Kingdom, Desiring the Kingdom is the first of his trilogy, great book. And he emphasizes this Augustinian theme in that book of desire. That what objects of the world and the world do, inasmuch as they participate in God, is they are meant to evoke our desire, so as to lead us to worship our God. That's what created objects are meant for. Now, we use them often in wrong ways. We use them as ends in themselves, but that's what, for Augustine, they are meant to. So we are to use them in his language. And I don't mean abuse here, our common language of use, but his language of using is to lead them into the presence of God in worship. Enjoyment of God, ultimately. So when we talk about sacrament, mystery, real presence, we typically tend to think Eucharistic worship, liturgy, and we ask the question, is Christ really present in the Eucharist? And we have all our debates between sacramentalist positions of various sorts, memorialist positions of various sorts, and again, those discussions, although I think in some sense they may be overdone, but they're important discussions. But they're not discussions just about sacramental theology, the way we commonly understand that term. They're not just discussions about the liturgy. Liturgical language about Eucharistic presence is about a higher instantiation, you could say. It's about a higher instantiation of God making himself present to this world. in order for us to talk later properly about liturgy, Eucharist, also about scripture before that, to properly understand these ecclesial realities, to locate them properly, we need the metaphysic that makes it possible for us to talk about them. So what I'm trying to do with this first session is to lay the metaphysical groundwork, you could say. We need an enchanted universe, an enchanted cosmology. If we are to understand theologically what it is that we do when we expose the scriptures, and what it is that we do when we celebrate the Eucharist together. And for the Church Fathers and medieval theologians, the most basic assumption to all of that is that Christ himself, and I'm purposely using Christological language here, that Christ himself is the reality, the res in liturgical language, R-E-S, the res, that is the depth dimension, which the language I used earlier, the depth dimension that upholds and that is present in everything created. Everything points to and shares in Jesus Christ. Just in case some of us get really nervous at this point, I think, so do you mean to say that everything is sacramental in the same sense, whether I'm participating in the Eucharist or whether I am walking around out in the field somewhere enjoying God's good creation? No, I'm not quite saying that. Right? And I understand that my book could have had a little caveat that made it very explicit that that's not what I'm thinking. And I wish I would have done that, because I often get asked that question. Do you think that everything's sacramental in the same way? No, it don't. And once we get to the Eucharist specifically, that I think will become clear. Why is this sacramental presence important, and what does it have to do with our lives in a late modern society? Well, let me begin by sharing with you some of the key elements that motivate my doing theology, the way in which I do theology. And there's probably two factors that inform that as a mission. And the first is the two that I already dropped earlier, namely mystery. It seems to me that when we're face to face with the mystery of the triune God, theology needs a great deal of modesty. One of the things I dabble in a lot of Catholic theology, as some of you may know, and one of the things I love in Catholic thought is that often Catholic theologians will talk about certain doctrines or dogmas as the mystery of Christ, the mystery of the Trinity, the mystery of, etc. I love that. Mere designation, because it reminds us that this is not about me mastering this field, right? It's about me entering into, also through the intellect, to be sure. Intellect is not a bad thing, it's a good thing, it's a gift. But it's about me entering into, or rather about us entering into, the presence of the triune God. So St. Anselm, in his proselogium, quotes Psalm 27 at several key moments in that book. Psalm 27 happens to be my favorite psalm, and it's about entering, or it's about seeing the face of God in the temple. And Anselm writes at, it's in section 18 of the proselogium. He writes there, "Do thou help me." Much of this is in the form of a prayer, right? And that itself should tell you something about the way in which theology was done by Anselm was often seen as a precursor of intellectualism in Western theology. I think not so much. Everything is still in the form of a prayer, or not everything, but most of it. Do thou help me for thy goodness' sake. Lord, I sought thy face. Thy face, Lord, will I seek. Hide not thy face far from me. This is Psalm 27:8, right? Free me from myself toward thee. Cleanse, heal, sharpen, enlighten the eye of my mind, that it may behold thee. Let my soul recover its strength. With all its understanding, let it strive toward thee, O Lord. What art thou, Lord? What art thou? What shall my heart conceive thee to be? Notice he has a lot of talk here about the intellect, about conception, understanding, about beholding. Those two are closely related for St. Anselm. But it's all part of a search. It's all part of a journey, of a pilgrimage. And the pilgrimage aims at beatific vision, right? Seeing God in the hereafter. That's what it aims for. The whole book is a journey toward the beatific vision. Not just an argument about, an ontological argument for the existence of God. It contains that, but throughout, he's saying, Lord, I'm still looking for you, I'm still searching for you. He recognizes, in other words, the mystery of God. I think that's an important element in light of modernity's rational overconfidence. An overconfidence that has at times also troubled Christian theology. So modesty in the face of the reality, capital R, that we're dealing with, is important when we're theologizing. Now, I do want to note the sound of caution on this score. For when in our late modern or postmodern context, we're talking about epistemic humility, and we're talking about modesty in terms of intellectual capabilities, we sometimes tend to veer toward a postmodern skepticism in which not only do we not think we can master or comprehend truth, but in which sometimes we tend to think that we cannot even enter into truth. It's an important distinction to make, right? Between mastering or comprehending, on Aquinas' language, comprehending truth, on the one hand, which indeed we cannot, and entering into truth. Our intellectual apprehension, or Anselm's discovery journey in the prosodic, he's not just playing with words. And he's not thinking he's just playing with words. He's truly seeking the one who has always already revealed himself in Jesus Christ. Otherwise, the entire search would have been a vain search. So he has, in some sense, a deep confidence that his epistemic gifts have been created so as to be fit, so as to be congruous with divine revelation of Scripture, and also the creative order in which he's been placed. So, humility, something that should be expressed both when we theologize and when we enter into liturgical worship. That has to do less with skepticism or my understanding of it than it does with mysticism. Theology is a mystagogical discipline. It is about, and worship is, liturgy is a mystagogical discipline or practice. It leads one, and it leads a congregation, into the being of God. Second, my concern about rational self-confidence is concerned with mastery rather than mystery. has to do with the second factor that drives much of what I'm about in doing my theology. And that is, I have a concern about our often uncritical acceptance of contemporary culture. Mm-hmm. Too easily, I think, we tend to give in to the temptation of accommodation. Accommodation to the latest fads in the culture around us. Sometimes I worry naively and uncritically accept the dictates of a society that in many ways has become post-Christian. Whether it's secular criticisms of our past, or whether it's certain political agendas, I wonder about the backbone of our intellectual and moral commitments. We look askance far too easily at countercultural Christianity and opt for accommodation to our surrounding culture. One of the things that pervades, I think, Bob Weber's books is precisely that concern that the church be an alternative culture. Whenever he talks about the various models of Christian culture, as he does in various of his books, as you probably know, he tries to be even-handed with these models. But usually it comes to the fore that really what he really thinks the church must be is its own culture. It needs to take a stance and be what it is. It has its own distinct identity. There's something profoundly true about that, it seems to me. I don't have an Anabaptist background at all, a Reformed background. And I don't theologically locate myself either in an Anabaptist tradition. But certainly the Anabaptists are the ones who should be teaching us about ecclesial identity and about a willingness to speak up and, if need be, to be martyred for the Christian faith. At the same time, we have shared humanity. We have a shared participation in the life of God. We have a common participation in being, to use very Platonic language, and a shared participation in being. But that shared participation isn't the only thing that needs to be affirmed. The way I understand participation in being is that there are varying degrees of intensity in participation. Higher degrees of participation in being and lower degrees of participation in being. What evil does on much of the Christian understanding of evil, what evil does is, or what evil is, let me put it that way first of all, what evil is, it's not some substantive entity in its own right. Rather, it's sort of like a bloodsucker. It takes the life out of you, right? It reduces you. Just like what we say about someone who's just done something unspeakable, we say, that person diminished him or herself. Right? You're less human as a result of it. Very true. When we engage in evil acts, when we do something we should not have done, we're less human as a result. Christ is that true humanity, that new humanity. When we sin against him, all sins against Christ, when we sin against him, we're less human as a result. Evil sucks the life out of us. So, accommodation to culture. However we may want to talk about that, and sometimes we have our own Christianese ways of talking about that, right? We talk about the goodness of creation, and we assume that everything can just be affirmed, therefore. Oh, we say, well, we can redeem. This is my own Reformed background talking, right? We can redeem X or Y or Z. And before you know, we can redeem everything in the world. We need to be profoundly aware, I think, that participation in being comes in degrees. And we need to be aware to the degree in which modernity may, in certain areas, collude with a diminishing in being, a diminishing, therefore, also in truth, goodness, and beauty. Some appeals, in fact, some appeals to the goodness of creation actually turn into their very opposite. Why am I saying that? If you don't have a participatory understanding of reality, and you focus strictly on that which the senses and the intellect can access, that is to say, if you focus strictly on it, on this worldly realities, and you celebrate them over against Augustine's insistence, you want to celebrate them for their own sake, perhaps with an appeal to the goodness of creation, or even perhaps the sacramentality of the world, but you focus on them for their own sake, what you end up doing is you're idolizing them. You're making them ultimate. And when you're making them ultimate, you're actually rendering them subservient to your desires. You're rendering them subservient to your own desires. Which is why St. Augustine's understanding of sin, sin is misdirected desire. Desire that should be aimed at God Himself is instead geared towards something this world, something good in itself, which is why our desire gets misdirected. Something good. But it's misdirected because it's not geared ultimately toward the enjoyment of God. When we render whatever created object it is, whatever created reality it is, subservient to our desires, our personal subjective desires, we subject them to ourselves, and we are the ones in control of them. It has everything to do with power. We are the ones in control of the objects of our desires. It's not really a celebration of the goodness of creation at all. Right? Not really a celebration of the goodness of creation at all. We think we are celebrating creation. We're actually undermining it. Let me give you a quick example if all this talk is too abstract. There's a lot of talk about how the environmental questions that we're struggling with today, how that is related or not related to the Christian faith and to the Christian past. Some of you may be familiar with a famous article written by Ian White, I forget the date of it, I think it was 1985 or so, on Christianity and the environment. And she blames the Christian environment, or blames the Christian faith for the problems that we're dealing with. The way I understand our environmental crisis is in the light of this sacramental ontology. If, or let me put it this way, to the extent that we lose the sacramental ontology, we objectivize, to use a different term, we objectivize the created order, and we use it to our own ends. Why is it that we're struggling with environmental issues in modernity, and why is it that in no other culture, in no other times, have there been such tremendous difficulties in properly caring for the world that God has given us? I think it has everything to do with a celebration of the creation that turns into its very opposite. So two caveats, therefore, to our notion, or to the notion that we must celebrate creation. Two caveats. One, the creative order has its truth, goodness, and beauty, not from itself. It has it by way of borrowing, by way of participation, by sharing in the eternal truth, goodness, and beauty of God Himself, rather than having that on its own. So we dare not assign it ultimate significance. To quote Lewis once more, the books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It wasn't in them, it only came through them. And what came through them was longing. Oh, the language here, longing, it's a language of desire again. What came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, that's the key line here, right? If they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they are not the thing itself. They're only the scent of a flower we haven't found, the echo of a tune we haven't heard, news from a country we've never yet visited. It's almost like you're really saying, Ansel, right? He still hasn't visited the country he wants to visit. He's still on a pilgrimage, in other words. C.S. Lewis is simply echoing Ansel and saying, I don't quite feel at home here. Perhaps one of the greatest difficulties that we have, both in theology and in terms of our liturgical entry into the life of God, is the fact that we're just too at home where we are. We need to have a sense of being aliens and pilgrims, of being exiles still, I need to move a little more quickly, I think. I'm going to leave that thing on the outline for Augustine, use and enjoyment. I think I've talked about that along the way anyway, so we can skip that. Second caveat to that notion that the creative order is good. It's a goodness, yes, but it's a goodness that is grounded in its participatory status. This goodness of creation is grounded in its participatory status. That is to say, its goodness is not its own. By separating creator and creature, we are forced to locate the significance of the creature. We're forced to locate its goodness, its truth, and its beauty in itself. In that part of it, as it were, that is observable by the senses. And we forget that this creature exists no more than by sacramentally sharing in God. Or, to use language of vision, it is by God's light shining, by God looking on us, that He keeps us in being. And it's that look of God toward us that enables us to return that gaze and to look back to Him. So there's a limit to the status of the created order. It is God's word, it is God's gaze on us that sustains us, that providentially holds us in being. The modern notion of a separate creation, a creation that carries its own truth, its own goodness, its own beauty, cannot avoid, metaphysically, cannot avoid idolizing the created order. So only God is to be enjoyed for His own sake, first point. And second, creation only has a sacramental participation in the life of God. Now for much of the Christian tradition, There's basic metaphysic, if you wish. This sacramental understanding of the entire order was argued for by means of Christian Platonism. I want to say a few things yet in the time that we have about Christian Platonism. First of all, just to be crystal clear here, you cannot be, as a Christian, a straight-up Platonist. Alright? You cannot, as a Christian, be a straight-up Platonist. Platonism, after all, is a pagan philosophy, and as Christians, one must know when and where to say no to whatever form of pagan philosophy one may encounter. But I do confess to being rather skeptical of the lampooning of Platonism in much also Christian theological discourse. Sometimes one gets the impression that it's only recently that some Christians, perhaps some evangelicals, have now finally managed to recover the importance of the body, have finally managed to overcome the otherworldliness of the Platonic tradition. The aim of this is usually a good one. The aim of this anti-Platonic rhetoric is usually a good one. For the aim is to be biblical. Right? And in order to be biblical, let's toss aside that wrong-headed Platonism. That's the thought usually. The effect is a different one. The effect is a different one. The effect is usually a radical horizontalizing and a radical historicizing of our relationship with God. And that approach toward Platonism tends to ignore that Christians often, usually in fact, rejected the excesses of Platonism. Christianity has always insisted that God is free and that God creates the world ex nihilo, out of nothing. The Christian faith has always insisted that God not only creates this world that we access with our senses, but that he entered it and that he assumed human flesh. It's the very core of Christian faith. At the very core of the Christian faith too, in the Apostles' Creed, I believe in the resurrection, the body. No Platonist will say that. No straight-up Platonist will say that. Christians do, and Christians always have, including people such as C.S. Lewis and others who would have called themselves Christian Platonists. These are not Platonists all the way, in other words. For the Christian faith has always had reservations vis-a-vis Platonic tradition. But it has also recognized in some way within the Platonic tradition an ally, particularly against the secularizing that would separate the natural order, quote unquote, the natural order from what is sometimes called the supernatural order. What an alliance, quote unquote. And it's a tentative, ad hoc alliance. But what an alliance with Platonic metaphysics does is it prevents us from separating these orders. It helps us recognize that God's grace and God's sustaining love undergirds the natural order in Christ, from a Christian understanding of this, in Christ, undergirds the creative order from the get-go. So that there is no purely natural world. So that there is no purely natural world. I want to end this section with a beautiful quote from Robert Bricker, which you have in your outline there, from his book. If you want to read one book on patristic theology, make it this one. All right, it's awesome. Spirit of Early Christian Thought. He writes there, the notion that the development of early Christian thought represented a Hellenization, right, turning to Greek, in Greek thinking, the Hellenization of Christianity, has outlived its usefulness. The time has come to bid a fond farewell to the ideas of Adolf von Harnack, the 19th century historian of dogma, whose thinking has influenced the interpretation of early Christian thought for more than a century. It will become clear in the course of this book, Spirit of Christian Thought, Early Christian Thought, that a more apt expression would be the Christianization of Hellenism. Though that phrase doesn't capture the originality of Christian thought or the debt owed to Jewish ways of thinking to the Jewish Bible. So what he's saying is, let's not poo-poo the Christian tradition for its Christian Platonism simply because it was quote unquote a Hellenization of Christianity. No, Christianity entered into the pagan world and transfigured it in some way. Transformed it, if you wish. Transfiguring, I think it's more biblical in better language. Transfigured. I'm going to probably stop there.